I haven't finished yet, but the idea was to... how the conformal field equations work, and I think the title of this talk is slightly misleading, but I'll explain why later on. Pardon? Yeah, you can always do that. I wanted to start with some advantages of the two approaches as I see them, two different approaches, namely the ADM approach and the conformal field theory approach. This is kind of subjective. It's on. This is a list of advantages I see of the ADM style approach. It's not meant to be exclusive in the sense that other approaches could share these advantages, but for one thing, it's the non-trivial fact that you have large sets of initial data ready to go to run an ADM code with multiple black holes and so forth. You have sort of compatibility with implementing what I call geometric gauge conditions, things like maximal or CMC slicing or spatially harmonic gauge and so forth, and this may play useful roles in avoiding singularities and so on. Connected with that is amenability to a fully constrained approach whereby you might want to solve the constraints, if not resolve the constraints, if not on every, at least on every time step, so they don't run away. Why I say, I mean, this is sort of connected with being in maximal or CMC slicing, because then the constraints decouple and they're relatively straightforward to resolve. Not that it's inexpensive numerically, but if you have to do it, you'd prefer to be in one of those slicing gauges. And here, the last thing I think is rather impractical. Is rather impractical in a full 3D code, but it was feasible in the U1 situation. That is, you can completely reduce the Einstein equations to just the evolution of the two functions that represent the two degrees of freedom. And many years ago, Roger Rovet had a working code for the U1 problem, cosmology code, in which that complete reduction was part of the code. So you just had two functions to evolve, not the 40 or 50 that people often end up having to evolve in other approaches. I'm not saying that's practical for a full 3D code, though. At least I don't know how to formulate it. Look at the other side of the coin here. The conformally regular field equations approach has many advantages, too. These are ones that seem clear to me, and possibly there are others, but first of all, you can extend the grid clear out to Sky Plus and or beyond and without loss of resolution for outgoing waves. I mean, an outgoing wave on a hyperbolic slice really only makes a finite number of wiggles going all the way out to Sky Plus, and so you can use a finite grid to capture that behavior. And there's natural boundary conditions at Sky Plus, in particular no incoming radiation. Several of the things that came out in Peter's talk were that, at least for the problems dealt with so far, this grid sucking problem seems to be minimized in his slicing, and so perhaps excision may be unnecessary. The constraints seem to behave stably during the free evolution, that is, they're not being reimposed, but they nevertheless seem to be under control, which is a nice feature. I'll come back to that point later. I've mentioned several times why I think that's possibly happening in his particular code. And furthermore, if you want them, of course, you're automatically computing curvature quantities. You don't have to do a separate calculation. And so what I was asking myself last year is, can you sort of incorporate both sets of advantages into some single scheme? Could you do a kind of an ADM approach that has the advantages of the conformally regular approach? And I don't really know the answer, but I'll show you what I do know. And I think the answer is yes, but it takes a little more work to do that. this next transparency is maybe a little out of date. Let me just say in words what the idea is. If you take in any form you like, say ADM or otherwise, the Einstein equations, and try to write the physical metric as 1 over omega squared times some unphysical metric, and omega is going to go to 0 on scry, write down the Einstein equations, you'll pick up a lot of singular terms, things like the Hessian of omega divided by omega and so forth. But, of course, secretly, all those singular terms have to add up to something regular because they're equal to the Einstein tensor of the unphysical metric, which is supposed to be regular all the way out to scry. So somehow, this is of no use to a computer, of course. The computer can't take a bunch of singular terms and add them up and hope to get anything that looks regular. But if you could first recognize what those singular terms do add up to, you might be able to write regular evolution equations for them. And so you'd be thinking of the Einstein equations as looking like the Einstein equations for the unphysical metric with a source term, but secretly that source term which looks singular is actually regular, and you find some regular evolution equations for that source. So that's the idea of it. And let me show you how it works in practice, or how at least one approach seems to work. Yes, I was... No, I'm going to go through that here. I'm going to work on hyperboloidal slices that tilt up and go to scry. And just to get warmed up for doing that, let me show just the prototype for this setup, which is to look at Minkowski space compactified in the spatial direction. And so start with a Minkowski space and standard coordinates, and then introduce a different time function, capital T, whose level surfaces are just these hyperboloids that tilt up and go to scry. Kappa is a constant, which I'm going to hold fixed. It measures the mean curvature of those hyperboloids, or also the intrinsic curvature. But so kappa is just a fixed non-zero constant. And then instead of using the coordinate r that goes to infinity, just introduce capital R, which goes between 0 and 1, and re-express the physical metric, the S squared physical line element, as some conformal factor times an unphysical line element. And you can read off what the conformal factor is here. It vanishes on scry, which is going to be at R equal 1. And one can, just writing this out in blue at the bottom, see that the unphysical line element has a nice form. For example, the spatial metric is just flat. There's a shift vector and a lapse function. And the picture has been compressed then, at least to the future of this hyperboloidal surface, into a cylinder with the boundary here at R equal 1 representing scry and the light cones tipped out like that. Each one of these level slices, horizontal slices, would be a hyperboloidal slice in the space-time, the physical space-time. So one can write, generalize this picture to non-flat metrics just by writing down a more the general ADM form, let's say, of the unphysical metric with a conformal factor in front, and read off the relationship between the usual ADM variables and those of the unphysical metric, which I represent by gamma and usually putting a twiddle over things. That's backwards from Helmholtz conventions. I'm sorry about that, but those are the ones I started with. And then start decomposing the ADM equations. This was just a brute force calculation to see what happens. And I was a little surprised at what happens, but I can show you in a couple of slides what happened. So you start with the physical ADM equation. Here's the defining equation for the, if you like, the momentum, or the, it's really the second fundamental form that's sitting here. I write it in terms of ADM momenta. So you can just plug in these definitions and decompose this equation algebraically into a nice one for the conformal factor here. Well, it would be a nice evolution equation for the conformal factor if you were given the mean curvature of the physical space-time, that's tau, and if somehow you knew this quantity in brackets, and if you look carefully at that, it's nothing other than this whole quantity in brackets is nothing other than the unphysical lapse times the unphysical mean curvature of a slice. So somehow this would give you an evolution equation which is conformally regular. Notice there are no omegas in the denominator, and this will tell you how to evolve omega if you knew this quantity. Some people think about fixing this quantity by just imposing an algebraic condition on, say, the determinant of the conformal metric. I want to do something a little different. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting out of order here. So that was the trace part of the defining equation. Then you get a traceless part that just looks like this. This represents the traceless part of the ADM momentum. Notice that everything here is conformally regular. I don't have any omegas in the denominator. This is the shift vector, which is common to both the physical and the unphysical metric. I still need to know this. This is the same quantity that appeared in brackets in the last transparency, and I have to know somehow what that thing is. Some people would suggest perhaps that you just fix this by insisting that this is the time derivative of the determinant of the unphysical metric. Perhaps you could just set that equal to the determinant equal to a fixed volume element, and this would be zero, and then you have some condition for the shift. That might be fine. I have an alternative suggestion which will appear on the next transparency, but somehow or another we need to determine what this quantity is, and it's nothing other than the unphysical lapse times the unphysical mean curvature. Yes. No, because the way I parameterize the metric, the shift sits inside the conformal factor. Let me flash back to the previous transparency here. In other words, if I write ADM form for both the physical and the unphysical metric, then this is the same x here as here, because, I mean, this factor multiplies everything, but somehow the way I parameterize it, the shift stays the same. Yes. Well, I'm going to impose, of course, the Einstein equation, just vacuum for now, on the physical metric and try to see where that leads. I mean, of course, you replaced what looked like 10 functions with 11, so you have to impose something from the outside to fix that 11th function somehow, and there are various ways of doing that. Well, I'm going to effectively do that, but it'll turn out to be the same quantity, much like the shift is the same quantity. If you write it, let me go back to this transparency. This is the sort of ADM form of the traceless part, at least, of the usual evolution equation that, you know, defines what pi is. And notice here, this looks like standard ADM, except for the unphysical metric. I have gamma and n twiddle. But this is the same pi, traceless part of pi that appears in the... So what I'm saying is, if I wanted to define pi twiddle, I would just put a twiddle over that and say that it's the same guy, and that will figure into the equation. So in some sense, there is an unphysical pi traceless, but it happens to be equal. This is a tensor density, as I am a contravariant. I mean, if you start raising and lowering indices, then you'll introduce factors that are not the same. So how does one determine that quantity that appears here again in brackets? This was re-expressible as non-physical lapse times non-physical mean curvature. We somehow need to fix that, and one way of doing it, as I've mentioned, is just to set this equal to zero and find some way to fix the shift. But I have another suggestion that might be useful, and that came about from just computing the time derivative of the three-dimensional scalar curvature of the unphysical metric. Here's just what you get if you just evaluate that time derivative using the equations that came before. And if you think about Yamabe-type problems, you might imagine that we could use the freedom of a conformal factor to scale this scalar curvature to be what we like. Now, that requires some thought about the boundary conditions and so forth, which I haven't done carefully. But let me just imagine that we could fix this to be what we want, maybe a constant zero or what you like. Notice that what you get here is a conformally regular elliptic equation for the quantity we want. This whole equation is conformally regular, somewhat to my surprise, by the way, because the other elliptic equations you tend to encounter pick up factors of omega squared multiplying the top order term, but that doesn't happen here. So you get a conformally regular elliptic equation for this quantity we want. So one suggestion for determining this quantity is to just fix the scalar curvature of the unphysical metric appealing to Yamabe theorem and use that to determine what effectively is the mean curvature of the unphysical spacetime by this elliptic equation. I'm not sure if that's the best way or even a good way, but it's one possible way. So, things are going too smoothly up to now. We haven't encountered any singularities, but surely they have to come somewhere. So here they are. When you write down the main evolution equation, this is just the standard ADM form of the evolution equation in Hamiltonian variables. It looks like this. There's the Lie derivative of this conformally regular guy with respect to the shift vector, which is still, this is regular because we've decided that this thing should be regular and that the shift is as it was before. This turns out, if you plug in the omega factors, to be regular. The omega factors cancel out of this term. But everything in these brackets contributes something singular when you plug in the transformation to non-physical variables and omega. I will show you what they are later, but I mean, I guess I don't have a transparency showing you what all the singularities look like, but every one of these three terms contributes something that's singular. So that's where the problem is. But what I noticed by fooling around with this is that everything in these brackets here can be re-expressed in terms of things that are supposed to be conformally regular. In other words, the idea is that term by term, this contributes singularities, but it equals something that's regular, because if I put all the regular terms on the other side and maybe even take out the regular terms from here, there are also regular terms in here, and move them to the other side, all those apparent singularities add up to something that's supposed to be regular. So what is it? Well, the answer is supposed to be shown here. That is, all the terms that contribute individual singular terms can be re-expressed, and this is just plugging in the definition and working it out, re-expressed in terms of manifestly regular things where these terms, this should be written as pi times some constant, which I didn't bother to work out. This is basically the conformally regular traceless part of pi as before. This is all conformally regular factors. This is the conformally regular lapse, and I mean the non-physical lapse and Ricci curvature and so forth. So the new thing is here a factor of omega out front, and the electric part of the physical dial tensor. And what that's given by, give it on the next transparency, just to remind you what it looks like in ADM form. I'm sorry, there shouldn't be an H bar. Where's?
Trace.
Oh, trace, 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 yeah. Oh, I see. Well, actually, it is TT. Well, you got the TT. I don't like TT because that could mean divergence with respect to one metric or the other, and it would be ambiguous. So this is the traceless part, but it does. It's also TT with respect to the physical metric. Now, what am I saying here? What I'm saying here is that this is the standard formula in ADM language, well, slightly expanded, for the electric part of the vial tensor. And if you expand it out by introducing the transformation of the unphysical metric, it also has singular terms, but they're supposed to add up to something regular in the sense that this is, well, maybe I'll show you what I mean by that in a moment. So what I'm saying is that you can hide all the singular terms that occurred on the right-hand side of the ADM evolution equation by just re-expressing those terms in terms of the electric part of the vial tensor plus some leftover regular terms, which modify what the formula looks like. And why do I regard these quantities as conformally regular? Well, if you write out in ADM form what their evolution equations are, there are no unpleasant factors of omega. This is the evolution equation for the electric, and there's a dual equation for the magnetic part. These are dualized mixed tensors the way I write them. Of course, there's many ways of writing these equations, but I just followed what seems to be the most obvious approach, and that was what appeared in the previous formula. So if you write down the evolution equations for these quantities and sort through, you'll see everything is conformally regular. That's no surprise, of course, because we all knew the vial tensor had nice conformal properties. But so what it looks like, compare the last two equations, and this is where I made up the title that Neil didn't like, saying, well, we have conformally regular ADM equations. Of course, that's slightly misleading because we've had to enlarge the system to include the system of evolution equations for E and B. That might not be a bad thing to do, but it certainly goes beyond the usual ADM equations. Nevertheless, it looks like if we're willing to do that, we have something like ADM equations that are conformally regular. Evolution equations. I haven't talked about the constraints here. Of course, we have new constraints now because we have to throw in the new constraint that E is defined by this and B is defined by its corresponding formula and check that all those are conserved. Of course, in some sense, in the usual ADM scheme, these equations are, one way of deriving these equations is to just impose the requirement that this constraint is conserved. That's a slight oversimplification, but I mean, in some sense, these equations are designed to conserve that constraint and its corresponding one for the magnetic field. Of course, you have to check that when you start modifying the evolution equations, and no longer guaranteed to work. But there's a more serious difficulty with what I've shown you so far that I think undermines using this as a set of evolution equations for the variables indicated. And let me flash back to the previous transparency and show you what that problem is. And I think, yes. Right.
Okay,
Well, the problem is there. Well, the thing is, I don't use this directly. I use the densitized mixed tensor form of that, so that puts in other factors of omega. So at the end, it's what I write here. In other words, I claim that this densitized mixed form satisfies these conformally regular equations, and it is itself conformally regular, and that's what appears here. Let me say it another way that maybe gets... You know, how did I find this? I explicitly split this formula into its regular and singular pieces and put in the appropriate density factors and so on, and found that the singular parts exactly coincided with the singular parts of the right-hand side of the ADM equation. So I'm not sure if that's a response to your question. Yes, well, that's right. That's right, yeah. Well, through this new constraint, but I want to introduce E as a new variable now. Yeah. Oh, the unphysical Ricci. No, it'll work. I claim if you plug in this definition... The claim is, if you plug in this definition, of course you have to multiply by the density factor and raise one index, plug in all the transformations, there'll be just a 1 over omega. I think that's what you were asking. In that form, there'll be just a 1 over omega, which is canceled by this omega.
Okay.
I see what you're saying now. Let's see. I'd have to look at my calculation to see what exactly all the singular terms are. You can't just... It's not true... Okay, maybe I've stated it wrong. It's not true that if you leave the ADM equations in their standard form and rewrite them in terms of the unphysical metric that you avoid 1 over omegas. They're there. And they reappear... They reappear if you just expand this out in terms of... I think you're right. This omega does not cancel all the 1 over omegas there. That's right. I'm sorry. I said it wrong. That's what I should have said. Thank you. Yes. Well, that would come from this evolution equation and boundary conditions on it. I skipped over. I mean, there was an evolution equation for omega here, first order evolution equation for omega, given at the bottom of the page here. It would determine how omega evolves if I knew what this quantity in brackets is, because then it's a nice first order evolution equation for omega. By the way, it actually forces certain boundary behavior on scry, which I didn't talk about, but notice if you put omega equals zero at the boundary of the cylinder, this term will drop out and this term will drop out, and that'll tell you what the gradient of omega has to be relative to other things. I mean, so I do have an evolution equation for omega, provided I know this thing, and that was this business of there are several ways of fixing it. One way would be to use the Imabe theorem, and I went through that. So I do have a nice evolution equation for omega. But you do have to put in something extra, of course, some extra choice, because you started with 10 functions for the metric, and you now have 11, and so there's some arbitrariness or ambiguity there. I believe... I haven't gone through the technical details. My desire is to fix the boundary and to choose the boundary conditions so that will stay fixed, and I'm fixed. And I haven't given the details because I haven't worked them out completely carefully, but my belief is that you can do that in this setup. You can choose your, and you can have a grid such that the boundary of this sphere is dry, or to the future of some hyperboloidal surface. Yes, it should. The equation, yeah, I have, I think I should.
Right at the bottom, last one.
Oh, here it is. All right. Okay, good. I mean, there were other implications at Scry, but I didn't go through those. There are also, I mentioned new constraints. I mean, you have to put in the definition. Well, I'm sorry, I got slightly sidetracked. I was going to come back and say why I think this is not a good system as it stands. And so let me go back to this transparency and show you what's wrong. First of all, these are the standard ADM equations. This is the standard right-hand side if you ignore conformal issues. Notice the sign of the Ricci tensor here. And if you combine this with the first-order equation for G, G dot is equal to something proportional to pi, you can see that in certain gauges at least, you can get a nonlinear wave equation for G just by plugging one of these equations into the other, and it hinges on the fact that to leading order in certain gauges, this behaves like a Laplacian with the right sign of the spatial metric, and it gives the rest of the wave operator on the metric. But if I push this up a little bit, you'll see something funny has happened. The Ricci tensor of the unphysical metric would try to complete the wave operator, but it doesn't do that because it comes in with the wrong sign now. So that if I combine this equation with the equation for gamma dot, try to impose something like harmonic spatial gauge, which makes this into something like Laplacian of the metric plus lower order terms, now I don't get a wave equation on the spatial metric, the unphysical spatial metric. I get an elliptic equation on the unphysical metric, and people have been complaining about instabilities in their codes, but if you want to see some real instabilities, just take an elliptic equation and try to solve the Cauchy problem for it. Every mode will be exponentially unstable. So this might suffer some difficulties. What happened? Well, you see, the correct sign of Ricci is hiding in the fact that these two electric fields contain Ricci. So there are two Ricci's here with a minus sign in front that if you reinstate what they are, you'll correct the sign here, but that undoes what you thought you were doing by hiding the singularities in the electric part of the Weyl tensor. So somehow the very hyperbolic nature of the equations is hiding in the new constraints, and I don't think that's a viable system that way. I don't think that would run on a computer. I mean, it would. Beverly tells me all the computer sees is the whole thing, and if you impose the constraint that this initially is what it's supposed to be, the computer will see everything correctly and know that it's a hyperbolic equation. My worry is not what happens on the first time step, but several steps down the line. If the computer can't properly keep the constraint that tells you what this is under control, then you'll start losing, and I don't know if that'll work. It might work, but I'm... Pardon? Okay, I'm not sure. So I'm not sure this will work. So what do you do if it doesn't work? Well, Helmut and I had a discussion yesterday, and more or less emerging from that, although this is something I had been toying with earlier as an idea, just rewrite everything here as the usual right-hand side of the ADM equation, plus some leftover terms, which will be conformally regular, because I'm not talking about this here. I'm talking about simply re-expressing these conformally regular terms, and many of them already agree with what they should be in the ADM evolution equations, but there are some are different like this, and some k-squared terms are different. So add and subtract the appropriate terms until what appears here is the usual right-hand side of the ADM evolution equations, but now for the unphysical metric, and collect the leftover terms. They will look like something I might loosely call minus 2e twiddle. Let's just call them e twiddle down here, and they will appear in parallel with this e and this e. But they will be at least morally something like the components of the electric tensor for the unphysical metric, whereas this was the electric part of the biotensor for the physical metric. So collect those other regular terms, put them down here, and now give those guys a new name and try to work out their evolution equations. And since they are going to have the same sort of form as the electric part of the physical biotensor, it'll be straightforward to work out their evolution equations. And since you have sort of conformally regular, rewritten this way, conformally regular ADM evolution equations for the unphysical metric, you don't expect to pick up any conformal singularities. Now, when I was comparing notes with Helmut, we decided that probably this could be easily cast into his way of writing things, and you could kind of see from his point of view what you were doing here in another way. This is sort of manifestly 3+1 in nature, so there's a certain amount of translation that has to be done. But so now, what's the final proposal? Do that and use this ADM evolution equations for the unphysical metric with a source term, which now consists of two pieces, sort of a difference of electric part of the physical biotensor and something I loosely call the electric part of the unphysical biotensor. I'm not sure if that's the right designation, but at least it's something you can work out explicitly. And then work out the evolution equations for these extra pieces. Now, the nicest thing would be is if you could take this whole extra piece as a unit with the extra terms that I haven't yet shown you, and derive a self-contained evolution equation for them. But in discussions with Helmut yesterday, we decided that probably isn't going to be the case. You'll inevitably mix in some piece of this by itself or this by itself, and you'll need two sets of extra evolution equations. That's my expectation. So the system is getting bigger and bigger and probably converging to something more like Helmut's scheme anyway, but in 3+1 language. And perhaps in this form, with the extra flexibility, which he could have put in himself, but I mean the extra flexibility of imposing ADM-style gauge conditions, that's what I wanted to do, preserve that flexibility and see where I can put it in. So if you write down the evolution equations for this, which we're already on another transparency, and the evolution equations for the extra pieces, and they're all conformally regular, and now this has been modified to look like just standard ADM for the unphysical metric, then you can impose more or less directly ADM-style gauge conditions. For example, I could take harmonic spatial coordinates for the unphysical metric and make this look like a Laplacian. Now it has the right sign instead of the wrong sign, and some elliptic equation for the unphysical apse, for example, the one that keeps the physical space-time sliced by CMC slices, and seemingly have a set of conformally regular evolution equations for all the variables. So that's what this sort of brute force approach has led to, and I think it would probably work analytically if you wanted to push through the details, in the sense that These evolution equations for the electric and magnetic part of vial, they're nice sort of standalone hyperbolic equations, and you're coupling that to equations which you can force to be elliptic hyperbolic by these kinds of gauge conditions and the observation that the equation for the unphysical metric now looks like a nonlinear wave equation with sources. So you ought to be able to make that work analytically. There's a lot of things to be checked. Now, by this time, though, you've enlarged the system a great deal, far beyond ADM, and very close to, I think, what Helmut and Peter already do. So what am I doing that's different, if anything? I think the only thing that I'm doing that's probably significantly different is trying to reserve the right to use these elliptic gauge conditions if I want to. And that's not currently what they do. I mean, they could do it, but that's not currently what the code does. So I think I've said all this in words anyway. Let me finish off by just a few comments about peripheral things that I've made in passing from time to time in the discussions here. But one is perhaps a plug for people to consider this gauge condition, which puts the usual ADM equations into elliptic hyperbolic form in a sort of straightforward way, namely the so-called spatially harmonic gauge condition, which in a formula looks something like this. That is, you restrict the spatial metric. Let's forget the conformal factor business now. Let's just look at the original ADM equations. You could do the same thing in the non-physical metric. Here's a formula that looks a little strange at first sight, but it basically is the gauge condition that defines these spatially harmonic gauge conditions. And leads to, if you time differentiate it, an elliptic equation for the shift vector. Yes. This one's a three connection, and this one's a reference. This one's the connection of some reference metric that you just fixed for convenience. In particular, if you allow this thing here, then of course you can start with any metric on any manifold and satisfy this gauge condition initially just by taking gamma naught to be the initial metric. So these guys cancel at time zero, and then try to stay within the locally defined slice by imposing this gauge condition. If you time differentiate it, you get the usual elliptic sort of equation for the shift vector. But there's something magic about that elliptic equation that Lars and I had to exploit in order to do our local existence theorem for this setup. And that was, the elliptic equation miraculously doesn't have second derivatives of the metric when the gauge condition is fulfilled. So somehow the vector Laplacian plus the other terms in that elliptic equation simplify to ones involving only first derivatives of the metric. So it's more like a scalar Laplacian in some sense than a vector Laplacian, which always would have second derivatives of the metric. So there's something magic about this, and we needed that magic in order to make our local existence theorem work, because we get nonlinear looking wave equations for the metric, and you try to write down energy estimates and so on. But the shift vector is driving all this stuff, and if it doesn't have the right degree of smoothness, we couldn't make the energy estimates work. Now, somebody who knows more about it might be able to make it work anyway. We couldn't see that it would work, and we thought the extra degree of smoothness that this magic produces is somehow important. And when I look at other elliptic equations that people discuss, the maximal to minimal distortion and so forth, I wonder if there's some difficulty brought about. I mean, I wonder if that can produce instabilities. I don't claim that it does, but at least it's something to worry about. If you have instabilities, you're using one of those gauge conditions, you might wonder if that's possible. I think I've already said this, whether that's the possible origin of the difficulty. Well, I think I think you're referring to the curvature of the curvature enters in. We were in that setting in the project with Lars, and that was a good sign for, but you mean if I were in the positive case, then I might be in trouble. I like to think of this project of slicing, you know, we didn't look at the problem of slicing asymptotically flat spaces with the hyperboloidal slices, but, well, except that you probably would encounter the Ricci curvature of the unphysical metric if you impose this condition on the unphysical metric, and that doesn't have to be. I mean, for example, in just slicing Minkowski space, that unphysical metric is flat, not yeah, not guaranteed. I mean, and that could be. I don't know. Lars thinks. Lars has a different way of looking at that elliptic operator. Yeah. Lars had another way of writing that elliptic operator that I haven't studied yet. He just showed it to me a few days ago, in which he claims that you can show it has trivial kernel in a much with much less delicate way. So if that really works, it might help to solve some of these questions. We were in a situation. Yeah, I couldn't. It sounds a little. I mean, I haven't studied it, so I don't. Well, there are too many talks, too many interesting talks to go to do any work while you're here. That's the one problem. But so I've said a certain amount here. I wanted to come back and say a little bit about other coordinate conditions. For example. I've mentioned this several times in passing, but I wanted to put it on, and Beverly mentioned it yesterday in her talk too, but there's something nice about having a at least non-zero mean curvature slicing, and this I think is helping in Peter's case. It doesn't have to be constant mean curvature, but as long as it's non-zero, and this would be true in any one of these hyperboloidal slicing setups, you get some advantage with the behavior of the constraints if you evolve freely. And so just to say this again, even though Beverly said it and I've said it, if these are the usual Hamiltonian momentum constraints, let's forget about the conformal factor and just do the standard ADM for the moment, but perhaps on a slice with non-zero mean curvature, then you can define this L2 norm of the constraints and calculate its time derivative. And I didn't take the time to look up in my notes the factor here, but basically, the time derivative of some positive constant times this quantity plus a bunch of junk terms which have indefinite sign. They depend on the gradient of the lapse and the second fundamental form. And basically, you don't have any good sign coming out of those. But this, in the case we're interested in, will have negative sign because n will be positive but tau will be negative. That's going toward the future of some hyperboloidal slice. And that means you always have this good term trying to drive this norm of the constraints back down to zero. Of course, it's fighting with these indefinite terms, which might be trying to make them blow up. But in a maximal slice, of course, this good term is absent, and you just have to fight against the junk terms, which could be helping you sometimes, but are more likely hurting you. And so I think this is one advantage of hyperboloidal slicings that you lose in the straight ADM approach, where you take something like maximal slicing or perhaps have a mean curvature that's indefinite and wiggles around. And that may be helping Peter's code to run so well in this kind of slicing. If you go ahead, this is sort of onto a different subject, but something Lars and I have been trying to exploit is the behavior of the Bell-Robinson energy in these cosmological spacetimes. But if you time differentiate the Bell-Robinson energy, which is defined by this formula, or even its higher order generalizations where you replace E and B by their gradients, you get that same good term that looks like the lapse times tau times the energy density integrated plus junk terms. And in the case that Lars and I are treating, you can actually exploit that for small enough data to show that these energies not only are under control, but they even die out to the future at long in the limit. So that's another sort of advantage of hyperboloidal type slicing. Let me come back and finish with another couple of remarks about harmonic spatial coordinates. I think I've said all this in words. This is the condition again. But a special case of that is just to take the reference metric to be flat in standard coordinates. Suppose you're working on R3, just take the simplest choice and put that equal to zero. Then this condition reduces to just the requirement that three space coordinates satisfy Laplace's equation. That, you know, if you write out this, you'll see it gives you that. So you may wonder, well, that couldn't possibly be nice enough for something highly curved like a black hole. But I actually studied that with a little model problem. Namely, just take a spherically symmetric metric where you can actually compute things, but don't assume a Schwarzschild coordinate here. So allow yourself the possibility that R could be not monotonic in little r, so you could have, say, a bag of gold type behavior that might develop as you cross inside a horizon or something. And just see if you can write down harmonic coordinates with good properties. I mean, I'm assuming there's a regular center down there. It's not Schwarzschild because I'm looking for basically a harmonic diffeomorphism from this three space to Euclidean three space. And if it's not diffeomorphic at all, I couldn't find a harmonic diffeomorphism. But if I assume I'm really on R3, I can look for a harmonic diffeomorphism of this form. And if you just plug that into the equations, you come up with these definitions here with a simple equation for what this factor K has to be. Here it's more convenient to write it in terms of proper length as measured out from the origin instead of coordinate distance. But this is the equation you get. And you can just examine that. No matter what R does, as long as it is doesn't have to be monotonically increasing, as long as it's positive away from the origin, doesn't go through zeros, that would correspond to the bag of gold pinching off. I can't allow that. But no matter what R does, I can show the existence of a well-behaved K with the properties needed, and therefore cover this bag of gold with harmonic spatial coordinates. I don't want to take the time to go through the details here. It's sort of straightforward, but you can show with, that it always works. And just for definiteness here, if you do specialize to Schwarzschild, even though that doesn't have a regular center, then in the Schwarzschild region, the solution of that, general solution of that equation can be written down explicitly, and this has with arbitrary values of the constants there. You can check that the region outside the region not covered by the Schwarzschild metric is behaved as it should be. There's no log there. No. There's no log. Yes, if I wanted them, I mean, to say that K behaves regularly at infinity, I have to insist that the actual metric is you know, flattens out there, and then I can show you what K looks like, and it has the right behavior in that case. So I'm not sure if that's a good enough reason to use them, but at least they don't go bad in any totally obvious way. And as I mentioned before, and this project with Lars kind of hinges on this, if you do use, and of course this happens, comes about for the same reason that if you use space-time harmonic coordinates, as Yvonne did many years ago, of course the full space-time metric satisfies the nonlinear wave equation. Here, if you just use spatial harmonic coordinates, it's the spatial metric that satisfies a nonlinear wave equation. But, of course, it's no longer a partial differential equation. It's rather non-local in the sense that to get into these coordinates and stay in them, you have to choose the shift vector to be the solution of an elliptic equation, and usually if you want something like constant mean curvature or maximal slicing, then the lapse would also satisfy an elliptic equation. So it's a non-local equation, more properly elliptic hyperbolic system rather than a hyperbolic equation. But if you're willing to solve elliptic equations on the computer, there may be advantages to do that. I don't know if they're strong enough to compensate the disadvantages of having to solve elliptic equations, but that's one the numerical experts have to decide. So I guess that's it. Thank you. Yeah.
If I were brave enough to take your first publication, I would write the personalized ABS. One of the things I would do is to put a weighting on the tracing pad side so that you keep it PT with respect to the only particular metric. It's only given minus one. And you didn't do this. And you see, I was looking at your equations and I couldn't see any place where it seemed to me that you didn't have any terms where if I did this, it would cancel. But did you actually try any other weighting onto the other the unweighted version that you did?
No, I didn't try. I guess I'm not sure a weight factor alone is enough to do the job. And of course, in some sense, what you're saying, I think, is the momentum constraint would now have a source in it. If you write it purely in terms of my pi and the unphysical metric, but in some sense, that kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that all the unphysical Einstein equations are now, you know, have source terms in them that came about from so. You know, you have to write that down eventually, but I don't know if you can do exactly what you said and compensate, sort of render this pi to be zero. Well, I mean, I think maybe this is what I mean. The mixed form of the densitized pi, the density pi. This will, you know, the divergence of this is equal to the divergence in the other metric. Just, I mean, if it's this is traceless. Pardon? Well, the problem is this is not the form of pi that I want to use, because then I have to lower an index, and that puts in a factor of omega. Maybe that's what you guys are trying to tell me. This is for traceless pieces here, but you know, that's a conformally invariant notion. Yes, it will. It would, but yes, that was the one that appeared like it's the one that makes it's the choice that makes the non-physical ADM equation look just like ADM. You don't have extra omega factors floating around. That's why I sort of chose to concentrate on that.
Okay. suggestion is that if you're a youth board, if you were to do particular kinds of drives, and I guess this is the wrong question to begin with, the problem is the education that is very but nowadays, at least, with certain assumptions, you can also start to kind of interest in there are still a few exceptions to use that it seems to be developed, but I mean, analytical stuff. So, essentially, I could start to use an analytical stuff. So, I think what's the separate is
well, let me say, let me come back to that point. I remember talking with you last year, trying to get a feeling for what the differences, if any, would be between trying to do this and what you already have done. And the question to me was, what role do the Einstein equations themselves play? And I remember you pointing out to me that you think of them as sort of overdetermined equations for the conformal factor, and it, well, but that's what you said, and that's what Peter said too.
I mean, they include equations for the conformal factor, which are overdetermined, but I won't say that the whole system is a system.
You didn't say that. No, I'm sure you didn't say that. But the point is, the philosophy of this was to. And then you have other equations for determining how. Well, I don't remember. You know, of course, you, of course, know what you have. But I mean, the point is, what I was trying to do here, and just sort of translating the ADM equations themselves into some form that I could recognize as conformally regular, is just to use the Einstein equations in the more conventional way that ADM people do to evolve the metric. In this case, the non-physical metric, and. Either through misunderstanding or misreading what you do, I didn't see that, and you know, somehow you work around that, the fact that the Einstein equations written for the unphysical metric would have omega in the denominator by multiplying through by omega, but then it appears multiplying the leading terms on the. You work around that somehow, and what I thought, what I was asking is, what if I just tackle that head on and see what happens, and this is what I was led to, but I certainly. Agree.
I agree. In terms of it being
I had hoped so, but but it looks more and more like that won't happen. I'll enlarge the system until I get something. Essentially, your system in disguise may be thought of a little differently in the sense that I single out the ADM evolution equations and just work with those directly, but then I have to supplement that with evolution equations for the physical and non-physical E's and so forth. That was one suggestion. No, you know, it would be a different. Partly, I mean, the reason I wanted to give this talk is that I think it's clear to me, working through this, that there's something, you know, some closer contact between the ADM approach and your approach than what I think most people realize, and that, you know, you can sort of perturb the ADM style of equations into something that's conformally regular if you're willing to supplement them by all these extra evolution equations, and that may or may not be of interest to some of the ADM people who, you know, sort of like to impose elliptic gauge conditions. Perturb them, yeah. Well, here's one of the people. Let's hear it.
I'm sorry, I like that.
jump into as well, so you can get those functions to go ahead. If you think that takes you too far away from the solution you like, that's coming from the other case, then you can put a lot of using all sorts of technical knowledge.
No, I guess when it's
I think. There's even a wild and crazy idea that Lars suggested. I don't think this works in practice, but his idea was to take the evolution equations for E and B and regard the defining equations that tell you that E is Ricci plus K squared and things like that, together with the corresponding one for B, as some kind of nonlinear elliptic system for G and pi or G and K with sources in terms of E and B. And I don't know of any direct approach except maybe implicit function theorem approaches to try to show that solutions exist. But I mean, will there be any systematic way of actually solving the equations for G and K? And they're so nonlinear and so coupled, it's hard to know if there's any. Are you assuming something like spatially harmonic? To make Ricci look like a Laplacian, you might. The only thing that bothers me, I was worried about this later, it seems like there's an implicit. That means you're in a particular, the solution you want is in a particular gauge, namely the spatial, but there must be some integrability conditions on E and B that are needed to allow for that. And
that's what the factors in a
They talk about it as though they can treat those.
Yeah,
yes, there's certainly elements of that in there. I don't know. Well, also, I mean, I think saying that space coordinates are supposed to be harmonic functions is a special case of the more general condition, which is really doesn't, it restricts the metric, but it's actually a tensor equation. In other words, this thing here that I first wrote down, because it involves the difference of two connections, is a tensor equation, which means if it's true in one coordinate system, it's true in any coordinate system. So you would say, well, what? That's right. But I mean, in some sense, you only really fix the coordinates once you decide what coordinates to represent this guy in. It may seem funny that you can fix coordinates by a tensor equation, but I mean, you have to put in something extra. Well, that's... Yeah, I think this... Or really restricts the metric to live on a certain slice in the space of metrics, and the shift vector is keeping you moving tangentially to that slice. I mean, thinking of it as finding X, Y, and Z that satisfy Laplace's equation that's a special case that you're right is too special to be of general use. But that's not really when you allow this more general way of thinking, you can, yeah. Yeah.
The difference is that the data comes from the fact that at omega equals zero, you that's infinity, and so you have to see the form of what is how it goes to infinity in a very special way. You will be able to divide by omega, which is zero, later on, which will actually be a difficult also. And that is the real thing for the difficulty in getting the new data for the conforming physics data. And if you want to do the step here, you know,
I think that's right. What I didn't know, though, and somebody may already know the answer to this, is whether if you reformulate, say, the Bowen-York prescription for trying to solve the initial conditions, I mean, setting aside the technical issues, does it even work when you have trace K not equal to zero? Suppose you wanted to resolve, so the only extra problem you have are the technical problem, and that may be very severe, but you at least the Bowen-York setup still works in that case for getting multiple black hole initial data. You just have to confront these extra technical problems that may be very severe, but
the problem with the tension is that to be able to solve the Amada equation, you need to have control over that boundary, so the omega is a zero
Well, why did it take mathematicians up to 1984 to solve the Amabi problem? Lichnerowitz equation was under control much earlier. I thought there's some difference, I thought. I mean, and adding terms doesn't make it simpler, it makes it worse. I thought there were different equations. Are you guys sure that that's... I mean, why did... Shane only finally solved the last Amabi problem in 1984.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Let me add again another thing that you mentioned at the end of your talk was the evolution equation for A squared and A squared. Do you think I learned 10 years ago? What was a very nice analysis of that, what he was asking was taking the standard ATM equation and adding multiples of the constraints on the right-hand side, so that it on shell, the constraints vanish, and so you can add any multiple of the constraints on the right-hand side you like, and then ask whether by doing that in some appropriate way, he could get extra control of the, what you call the flow term. And it's really interesting to see that you can, in fact, substantially improve your control of the dose curve by writing down the standard ADM equation. But, as I said, the modification is that you add in some multiple of the constraints. And so you actually have thought about...
Well, Alan and I were talking about possibly a similar thing yesterday, but we didn't work it far enough to see if by putting a little extra flexibility in, whether you get an extra term that's trying to suppress the L2 norm if you add the appropriate multiple of a Hamiltonian constraint. I think probably that's one thing that,
yeah,
that was happening.
And it
happens. And then earlier, I think Al-Kubier was talking about, you know, adding in various multiples. I have a particular multiple of a Hamiltonian constraint that's sort of built into the setup that guarantees that in a hyperboloidal slice, guarantees that good term. But you might be able to get a good, what I think you're saying, you may be able to get a good term even if trace K is equal to zero by fiddling around with the equations.
But you have to add in the momentum of state as well. It's not just the Hamiltonian. You've got to add in both.
Okay, yeah, I can see that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is published in Israel, like,
yeah, yeah, I know. I'm familiar with that paper. I'm just pointing it out that without doing anything, you get the good term.
Yeah.
I mean, at least for the setup, if you're willing to go to a spatially harmonic gauge, and of course we haven't done this on the asymptotically flat setting, but in the cosmological setup, we can show that our system with our choice really gives not only local but for small data a long time existence result. So it's a good setup for certain situations. I don't know if there's any, and I don't know how generally people have studied the alternatives, but at least this one seems to work very well. Well, that's a good thing to do, yeah. Yeah. Could you say that again? Are you doing? Oh, you have. Oh, I see. But you have a system. You have a scheme to solve the coupled constraints. That's a nice thing to have. Yeah. But is this a? I mean, to get initial data is one thing, but if you had, you felt you had to reimpose. Pardon? Oh, you're doing it on every few time steps or every?
And another thing with regards to that wire, I think we need to keep in mind that the strong man that you put it up there, and the instability and constant
Let me ask the numerical people, Matt, what it's confusing to me to hear about the gauge modes blowing up in various analyses or the constraint violating mode. Pardon? I mean,
because there's always, we have so few examples. In fact, I don't know whether we have any examples, but we may have some examples where we see an instability that we can really say, this is something in the continuum, not the visualization. Because when it comes down to actually putting things, we'll come down and make a discretization, and something blows up. And even if you can show that it's sort of approaching, it's blowing up in a convergent fashion, it still does not exclude the possibility that it's a bad discretization.
Okay.
And, I mean, this is nothing like the proof. It's just over the years, I've seen many, many, many examples now where things that look like it. The properties of the finite difference solution is just so much richer than the properties of the continuum. I do worry about these various analyses and violations of the you do have this, pretty good evidence for it. We have some evidence that rather straightforward implementation of whatever kind of equation you want to look at, the same implementation, can be to say that we can just say that we can do that.
So, I've heard you say something like this before. You were sort of doubtful that there's a magic elixir in something like the Baumgart-Shapiro scheme.
I think it's very telling in that case that it really is the outer boundary conditions seem to be the problem. And that if you look at what's happening with the Baumgart, with the McNair procedure, it evolves something that's fundamentally the unimodular method, which has a chance of being something that's the essence of our existence. It's like a theorem in the sense that it carries around a zero, and therefore would look something like a wave. So if you will, kind of just backing up the Kumon part. So it makes a lot of sense that then the intuition of that rather simple something called condition would be, and not only that, I mean, there's two factors coming there. You have imposed those something called condition, but then you have to systematize them again. And the key point is just because you have a well-folded mathematical formulation doesn't mean that any old systematization of these is just a story. But it seems that
So that's where the variable with the naive common condition, with the rather naive digitization of the common condition, produces something that's stable.
Yeah.
But it's not. Unconditioned long term is stable. And one of the things that the body mentioned, so that we didn't step in too much, but then possibly, is that we can prevent the breakdown of the problems of our system.
Well, I mean, I reminded Beverly, of course, with one killing field, so it's effectively 2B. 2D was running essentially just the straight ADM equations with harmonic time and zero shift, and of course the constraints were somewhat out of control, especially if you go in the collapsing direction, but there was, I don't think there was evidence of instability. I mean, you were going long, long times toward the Big Bang. When you went in the expanded direction, I thought you could even get away with just straightforward. Right. Well, but in 2D black holes, that's kind of what we're trying to do. Of course, I mean, two black holes, not 2D, but you're going in the direction which is analogous to our expanding direction. Well, it's not the same problem. Oh, inside the black hole, yeah.
That's not what we're talking about.
That's right. No.